Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast, a show for people around the world who are thinking and feeling deeply about climate change and other kinds of environmental issues and all the different things that are connected with that. And like we like to say, we're all climate all the time, all emotions all the time. So this is a time to just be present with how we're feeling. And we look at this in a lot of different ways and get really sometimes serious and intellectual about the research and the background and also how this plays out in our personal lives and in our families. And we are really, this is an international podcast. Panu's in Finland, I'm in the United States, and we do have listeners in 35 countries around the world. So we do try to keep it international here. And today we are keeping it international when we're lucky to have a guest with us.
Yes. Hello. Lovely to be here. My name is Frida Hylander. I'm located in southern Sweden, Malmö. Yeah, very happy to be here.
Frida, I'll have to make sure that I do this pronunciation as well as I can. That's a beautiful name. Panu, I know you both know each other and have had some familiarity with your work there. You want to get us started?
Warmly welcome, Frida, also on my behalf. Lovely to meet you here also. So Finland and Sweden are neighboring countries with a lot of common history, and luckily the cooperation extends also to climate psychology and its various various dimensions. So we've met with Frida in that regard, and Frida has been very active in the Swedish climate psychology scene. There's a very nice network of climate psychologists, Klimatpsykologerna, and we are going to talk about that more today. But there's also a newsletter in English, Climate Psyched, that you have been writing, and several of the fruits of your work are available also also in English. But before we go into that in more detail, it would be lovely to hear a bit about your journey towards being so active with climate psychology. So has that interest in the natural world been with you for a long time, or how did it go?
Yeah, so I'm a licensed psychologist and a specialist psychologist in psychological treatment and psychotherapy. But as I was studying to become a psychologist, I also started studying human ecology, which is sort of an interdisciplinary field that, you know, investigates humans' interactions with the ecosystems. And as I was studying that, I was really sort of emotionally hit by the magnitude of the climate crisis. I think that's when I first sort of understood, I guess, both intellectually and emotionally, like how bad things were. And this was back in, I guess, 2008, 2009. So, you know, things were, I guess, in one way, looking better than they are now. But anyway, so I was studying human ecology, and I was really, really struck by climate anxiety, even though I didn't have a word for that back then. And I sort of struggled with that. But it also got me to really think that, okay, so this is also what I want to do for work. And I was really frustrated with my psychology studies because they were so individualized. So we talked so much about, you know, what's going on internally and with people's thoughts and emotions and everything, and different psychiatric diagnosis and stuff like that, but we talked very little about the surrounding world and, you know, what the future holds. And then I was very frustrated with my human ecology studies, because there we talked so much about the ecosystems and political ecology and stuff like that, and inequalities and environmental injustices and so on. But it was, we didn't talk about like how, you know, how do people behave and how do groups, you know, what makes different groups change and how are societies formed and so on. So I think that, you know, my sort of path to becoming a climate psychologist or a psychologist working with climate psychology, you know, it came very much from that frustration. So, So after I was finished and finished with my all of the practicalities to become a licensed psychologist, I started to sort of find my way into working with this. But there's really been no, you know, there's nowhere you can apply in Sweden to become like get a job as a climate psychologist. So it's been sort of a very, you know, trying to create that path, which I've done on my own, but more very much more together with my colleagues in the climate psychologists, Klimatpsykologerna, which is a network that I co-founded back in 2018. So I'm here due to anxiety and frustration, I guess.
That's lovely testimony to the positive fruits of negative emotions, to use sort of binary expressions. And thanks a lot for sharing that. And that frustration with the individualistic tendencies in psychology is something we have heard from many pioneering climate psychology folks in this podcast, including Ro Randall, for example, and René Lertzmann and others. And Thomas, what's on your mind when listening to this Nordic story?
Well, I'm really appreciating it, Frida. I'm going to ask you about your background and if you found it difficult to study. And so you answered that question. And it's it's very, I can very much identify with that, that story. And it's a very common story, because this is I've just been trying to write about this actually for this manuscript that I'm working on. These are what they call, well, the one way to think about it, these are transdisciplinary issues. Like they're issues that fall in between the academic subjects that we study and the scientific disciplines. And I literally have the experience where you're, and students who are listening or academics will understand this, where you go to the department and you say to the psychology department, say, "Professor, I'm a student. I want to study climate change and why people are concerned about these disasters." And they say, "Oh, that's a really important thing, but we don't work on the environment here. I want you to go down the hall to the environmental studies department, and that's where they can help you look at this." And then when you walk down the hall to the environmental studies department and you say, "I want to study," they say, "Oh, that's really interesting, but we don't do psychology and therapy here. Therapist is in this department." So they send you to the therapy department, you know, and then it's a runaround, and students are left in the middle. And then tragically, some are even told, "Oh, don't take on this topic. It's too difficult and you won't be able to get your degree. And so just do something safe now to get your degree. And then you could work on this later." But then later sometimes never comes. So it's a real issue.
And so it is. Yeah, it is. And I think that's something that, you know, we very much notice here, and that as so say the psychology educations or psychology programs in Sweden, you know, they still very much like don't offer any training in these to prepare, you know, future psychologists to take on these issues. So that's something that we've been working on with. I'm chairing a national organization for psychologists called Psychologists for Sustainable Development, which is part of our union and our professional national association. And part of the work we've been sort of trying to do there is to, you know, contact the different psychology programs to sort of see what they're offering and why they're not offering more on the sort of climate and environmental issues, but also trying to explore, like, what do students feel like they need, and are students even aware that these are topics and issues that are important and that they will encounter, like, in their future sort of professional lives. But it's very much, I would say, it's not coming so much from the universities as it's perhaps coming from us or other sort of engaged psychologists, unfortunately. But and it's like a slow process of trying to get stuff in. There are a few courses sort of here and there in the psychology programs, but not very much.
And that's roughly the situation also in Finland. So about the only longer university course on eco-emotions has been run by me as an interdisciplinary research course. So it's one of these in between things. And in Sweden, of course, there's been the strong presence of Greta Thunberg and the children's and youth climate movement, and that really started getting stronger in autumn 2018. That's when I also first met Greta at the Helsinki climate demonstration, where we were both speaking. Well, she's done a lot more of that speaking since then. But would you like to share something to the international audience about how do you see those years in Sweden? I know that that's very intimately connected with any climate psychology work in Sweden.
Yeah, so 2018 was the year that we founded Klimatpsykologerna, or the climate psychologists, which we did in, in March, so in springtime. And we were sort of trying to, you know, figure out like what should we do and what's needed, what's the work that needs to be done or that we can offer. And then came the very, very a very hot summer in Sweden, and we had quite a lot of forest fires that were quite scary. And I think there was something about that summer that I think made people up here more emotionally aware of the climate crisis, because it all came sort of close. And then after that was when Greta Thunberg started her school strike, which was at first she was doing that every day leading up to the Swedish election. And then we had the Swedish national election, and I think the Green Party did a terrible election. But still, I think they were still part of the government. I keep forgetting, but I think they were still like part of the government eventually with the Social Democrats back then. But anyways, so I think there was just like a massive, something happened, you know, on sort of the national level. And I think the very hot summer was part of that, the forest fires, and then obviously like Greta's school strike and the formation of the Fridays for Future movement. Mm. So I think also for us, we noticed that all of a sudden, like the media also became aware that, okay, so this is actually an issue that that affects people on the more psychological and existential and emotional level. Mm-hmm. So we got very busy like straight away, and I think that's very much that was very much due to the forest fires and Greta. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And probably also the IPCC report, which came out that autumn.
I'm not sure though.
Okay. Well, at least in Finland, that was a big thing compared big thing in addition to the hot summer and children getting activated.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like that was, I think if the IPCC report had come and none of the other stuff would have happened, I think it would have just probably been another report. But I think that was, it was so highlighted by the other stuff that was going on. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that also happened in Sweden then was that people sort of became aware that, okay, so activism is also a way to take action, to do your part for climate. So I think it's also in one way helped to shift the conversation a little bit from the very, very sort of individualized discourse that had been before into a slightly more like taking collective action discourse.
Yeah. Yeah, this is helpful. I mean, I think this is a universal story in many ways that different countries and different regions have their collective waking up moments here. I got a chance to meet Nathan Grossman some time ago, the filmmaker that worked with Greta and did some of the filming, the film about her, her life and her trip to the U.S. to the U.N. And so much of that was just I want to turn this to some of the more inspiring parts of the work to you, because we've been talking about the difficulty of the work and the work in the trenches and in academia. And you know, kudos to you, Frida, for being a self starter and for forging a path. Pano and I know how that is as well, but it does start small, and you never know what's going to happen. When Nathan started filming Greta, she was just a young girl sitting outside the parliament or whatever, had no idea that it would turn into an international, media event. Before you started asking these questions in your studies, you know, we talk about environmental identity here and like our sense of our relationship with nature and the natural world. And that's a deeper thing than our academic studies. It starts in our early life and our family and where we grew up and our home place. What when you look back, what do you think are some of the origins of your connections with nature and your sense of yourself as a person in the planet like this?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, like I've never really had a strong, like nature identity or nature relatedness. I come from the west coast of Sweden, and I grew up in a sailing family. So I've always, I think the sea and sailing has always been sort of, that's, you know, the closest sort of relationship I've had with nature. But I've never really been like a forest, going out into the forest or you know, I know some people have a very strong, and I think I have that now much more, but that wasn't really, you know, how I sort of came into this. And I think like my interests have been more urban, I guess, than nature related. But I've always been very, very interested in you know, society. And I really found like the human ecology studies so immensely interesting. And also to study about the political sides of how we use nature, but also how different groups across the globe use nature in different ways, and how, you know, the global north utilize resources from the global south and then sort of send back piles of shit. You know, and it's, I think for me, that's been more like, that was more my way into this. But I think now, you know, I have such a much, much stronger and closer relationship with nature. And maybe that also something that perhaps comes with age, like a growing interest of like growing and plants and stuff like that, soil and everything. But I also think it comes with this work and with just like really on like a deeper level, realizing how immensely interdependent on nature we are, and how we truly, you know, we are nature, you know.
Yeah, warm thanks for sharing that. And speaking of Sweden's international contributions, those old Ingmar Bergman films often include sailing, yeah, sailing images. So listeners, if you want to take a look, you can try to search for those one. And those also really go to the existential level, both the joy and sorrow and those kinds of things. And we can put some links to the show notes. There's quite interesting research about Swedish environmental activists also. Mm. I don't want to go into too detailed academic discussions here, but for example, about how they relate to the Swedish version of climate anxiety concept, klimatångest, because that became heavily politicized. Mm. It seems to me that it became more politicized than in Finland. Also in Finland, there was a notable shift after the autumn 2018 and the next winter. Before that, for example, for me, it was much easier to talk with countryside people about climate distress because there wasn't this politicization yet. Yeah. But then things got more complicated and anyway, but there's interesting things to be read. And also these global dimensions. There's one article, for example, where there's interviews and observations of climate activists in Sweden and in South America, and how the emotions which come up also have differences because of these cultural layers and global solidarity issues and so on. So we are all interconnected, but it might be very useful for the listeners to hear a bit more about what you have been doing with the Klimatpsykologerna network. So what have been some of your major aims and major methods?
Yeah, so we do quite a lot of different things in Klimatpsykologerna, and we have, all of us are, there's five of us now in our little network, and we're all licensed psychologists, but we have some different niches. So some of us, from more like the clinical side to the more organizational side. And so myself and another one of my colleagues, we work clinically. So we do take on clients. And that's something that I've worked with in general as a psychologist. So I've done, over the years have had hundreds and hundreds of therapies with clients. But in recent years, they're almost only focused on people with climate-related distress. And we usually say that that's not the first thing to do when you're distressed about the climate, to go and see a psychologist. But sometimes, there's the distress becomes so unmanageable that it might be helpful to also have some therapy for that. But then we do a lot of lecturing about climate psychology and behavioral change, especially focusing on large scale behavior change. In recent years, we've also gotten more and more requests to lecture about climate anxiety and climate emotions, and workshops about that as well. So, and that can be for schools or institutions. Sometimes we lecture at different universities, but also for large companies, so commercial companies. Mm. So that's very wide, and then we also work in different projects. So sometimes we're just like as consulted in, and we offer our sort of expertise on climate psychology and behavioral change. And sometimes we run our own projects. So for example, we just last year finished a 3-year long project, which was aimed at supporting young people with difficult climate emotions. So we in that project, we developed a lot of different methods and materials, and did a lot of workshops out in schools with students, but also with teachers, to help teachers become more sort of well equipped to support their students. And then we try to educate about climate psychology. I don't know, in Swedish we have a good word called folkbilda. Do you have that in Finland, Panu? It's not just like educated, but it's more like, you know, we want the people to become more,
Yeah. Sometimes I think education researchers use the German concept of Bildung.
To describe that.
So,
maybe that's
in Finnish,
the best.
It's sivistys also.
Sivistys, yeah. So we do that, and we also write, write texts. So I have a monthly or bi-monthly now international newsletter called Climate Psyched. I also write columns for Sweden's largest environmental page, Supermiljöbloggen, and sometimes, you know, we write texts in different, papers and stuff like that. We're also, so we wrote one book back in 2019, and now we're in the process of writing a new book, which will come out next year. That will be in English. With the working title, Harnessing Collective Behavior, Climate Psychology and Resilience, I think.
Nice.
Something like, so we do quite a lot of different stuff. I also have a podcast with one of my colleagues, which is in Swedish, called Två klimatpsykologer möter, Two Climate Psychologists Meet. With the different guests, and
That's wonderful. Yeah, there's so many parallels. It's really nice to hear. It's very similar to the U.S. I have colleagues that are working, in with organizations and with businesses and with local governments and, listeners. We're talking some specialized terms here because in academia, certain psychologists, work in organizations and businesses. Some work with individuals. Some do therapy.
Yeah.
There tends to be people that specialize in all of these areas, and it's all important. They're all important. So it is quite amazing how similar it sounds to what I've experienced in the United States. So that on the one hand is very reassuring that, we're on the right path.
Hopefully. And I think also, at least for us, there's been no path. So it's very much been us trying to forge a path, and with that, I guess that also comes with trying different things and working in different ways. And I think that also sort of works well with our analysis of the climate crisis, that there's no one thing that we need to do. There's a multitude of things that we need to do, and we all need to use the competence that we have in various ways and try and reach different, groups and companies and individuals in various ways.
Yeah, finding your place on the planet, digging in and taking action from there, and trusting in the process. It's very hard right now. I know in the United States we have a lot of very regressive politics happening that are really trying to censor. It's really quite strange because everyone knows the reality, but there are still a lot of people working to try to erase, symbolically at least, the reality of climate change and various things, and to address other social movements. And so in the face of that, it's important to I think reach out across the world and realize that we're people are not alone. The takeaway from our episode and from all these episodes and listeners that wherever you are listening, you're not alone. I mean, we're all in every country. I mean, as you know, Frida, and probably talked about, 80% or more of people all around the world in every nation recognize climate change as an issue and want to make action. This is a universal reality, despite what governments in small places will try to do to turn back the clock. It's not possible. And so the larger reality is here, and so that we are building this larger, more ecological world in all these steps. So it is something to be aware of here.
Yeah, that's very inspiring, all the work that is going on. And as so often happens in this podcast, half an hour goes very, very quickly, and there would be many, many topics to dig deeper into. But Frida, I'd like to ask you about sort of coping tips in your experience, and you can approach this as a sort of combination of just a human being living in these times and as a licensed psychologist. So what would be some of your like top picks for how to cope with the world reality as it is?
Yeah, well, I do think that one of the most important things that we all need in this time of parallel ongoing crisis is a good social support. You know, we need our little collective and to feel that we're not alone. I think that is essential, and I think I just get sort of strengthened in that belief with each person that I talk to in my work, that the social dimension is so immensely important, and to feel that, you know, you're not alone, and to feel that there are other people who sort of share your emotions and worries and frustrations and sadness and sorrows and everything. So I think that's key, as much as, you know, finding ways of taking collective action, mm-hmm. you know, and feeling that, you know, hopefully with that, being able to feel like a sense of agency and a sense that, you know, there are things that we can do. We're not doomed. We're not helpless in this, you know. Right now there's a strong, like, repressive and regressive wave sort of coming, you know, over us, but we're not helpless. But we need our collective and the social support to feel that, you know, we do have agency. So I think that's important. But then also just to like find or give yourself permission and to feel whatever you're feeling. I mean, it's so reasonable mm-hmm. to feel whatever we might be feeling right now. You know, we usually say that emotions they're also information, you know, they mm-hmm. carry information about what's going on in the outside world, but they also carry information about what's important to us. So if we're feeling worried or stressed or frustration, you know, that's also information about what's important to us. And I think that's something to honor in one way. And just to, you know, to give permission to that and to give some space to that. And then I think like the last thing that I would like to add to that is also how important I think it is to give yourself permission to pause from the big world and the ongoing crisis. And I think that very much has to do with this being like a marathon. Like, this is the rest of our lives that we'll be dealing with the climate crisis and the other ongoing crisis. And, you know, we also need to sustain in that and to be able to do that. I think that we every now and then need to give ourselves permission to pause and to sort of zoom in on the little life, but also to with that remember that there's so much in this world that's worth fighting for. You know, there's so much in this world that makes all of the hard stuff worth it. So yeah,
very well said, very well said. Very I know I'm personally validated to hear. It's very similar to the things that I've been thinking about and writing about, and it's really nice to know that that's what you're all finding in Sweden as well. Mm. Well, Frida, thank you so much for coming. It's really nice. It's so, one of the things to be thankful for is that we have the opportunity for these dialogues, you know, around the world in real time. You know, you and I have never met, and here we are now. We know a little bit about each other and can carry that into our days. And Panu and I, you know, being able to have these conversations, and, you know, twice a month, we feel, you know, connected and meet people. So listeners, I hope you take something from this. If you're in Sweden, or if you're in the United States or Finland or any other country, you know, that you're not alone in doing this work. And we're Climate Change and Happiness. You can find us at climatechangeandhappiness.com. There'll be some good notes about Frida's work and some of the links to her newsletter and upcoming book and all these kinds of great things. And Frida, Panu, and listeners, everyone, be well. Take care.
Well, thanks, Frida. Tack så mycket.
Thank you for having me. Lovely.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.